This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Eyewitnesses say there was smoke trailing behind the Ethiopian Airlines plane that crashed Sunday morning, killing all 157 people on board. Sunday's flight left the airport just after 8:30 in the morning. Passengers from 35 countries were on that flight. Ethiopian Airlines has now grounded its fleet of Boeing 737 MAX 8 jets. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma.
The airline has grounded the fleet, it says, as an extra safety precaution following the devastating crash in which 157 people were killed, although it isn't yet known what caused the loss of the new plane in clear weather outside Addis Ababa on Sunday. The airline says its remaining four 737 MAX 8s won't fly until further notice. Some other groups around the world appear to be deciding to do the same. China's Civilian Aviation Authority has ordered all Chinese airlines to temporarily ground their MAX 8s, and Caribbean carrier Cayman Airways says it's temporarily grounding the two it operates. I'm Charles Ledesma.
The Trump administration Monday sent to Congress a more than $4 trillion government spending plan for the year 2020. President Trump is asking for $8.6 billion for construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border. That is in addition to the nearly $7 billion he has ordered to be used to build a wall under his state of emergency declaration. The budget calls for a 5% funding boost for the Pentagon and a 5% cut in non-military spending. Democrats now control the House, and few Democrats support the budget as submitted by the president. Algeria's presidency said that Monday that longtime leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika will not seek a fifth term as president. That's despite filing the paperwork last week. Presidency also announced that elections initially scheduled for April 18th will now be postponed. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The U.S. on Monday sanctioned a Moscow-backed base bank jointly owned by Russian and Venezuelan state-owned companies for its support for Venezuela's embattled President Nicolas Maduro and the country's state-controlled oil industry. The U.S. Treasury said it was targeting the bank, which was founded in 2011 to help provide financial benefit for the joint Russia-Venezuela oil and infrastructure projects, for allegedly trying to circumvent U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. Fierce fighting continued Monday in northeastern Syria. U.S.-backed forces continue what they say is their final assault on the Islamic State terror group Enclave of Baghouz. A spokesman for the Syrian Democratic Forces said IS militants are fighting back with suicide bombers. He says they damaged an SDF minesweeper. And as internationally backed Syrian forces continue what they believe is their final battle for Islamic State-controlled territory, more than 65,000 people, almost all women and children, have evacuated to camps in northern Syria. No one expected nor planned for these massive crowds, and many of those displaced are defiant, vowing that IS will rise again. From the camp in northern Syria, VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch reports on dangerous conditions there.
There are no adult men to be seen among camp residents, and most of the people are somehow related to IS. Many are their wives, widows, or children, and many have not lost their faith in the group. Thousands of foreign family members of IS fighters are kept separately, with many waiting to hear if their countries of origin will take them back. The future for Syrian and Iraqi families is also not clear. IS retreated for years as they were pushed out of cities and towns. The families are now far from home and may be rejected by their communities if or when they try to return.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani began a three-day visit to Iraq Monday to try to increase ties between the neighboring countries. His scheduled includes talks with the Iraqi president and prime minister. The visit is Rouhani's first to Iraq since he was elected president in the year 2013. An Indonesian woman held in Malaysia on suspicion of killing North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un's half-brother was released from detention on Monday. High Court discharged Siti Aisyah after Malaysian prosecutors withdrew the murder charge. Without giving an exact reason. I'm Tommy McNeil with VOA News.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, March the 12th, and here's some of the stories we are covering for you. Investigations are ongoing in what caused Sunday's deadly Ethiopian Airlines crash. The incident marks the second deadly crash of the popular planes in less than 5 months. It's raising questions about the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft. Indonesia and China are grounding their Boeing 737 MAX 8 fleet. In the U.S., Senator Dianne Feinstein is asking the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration to ground the Boeing 737 MAX planes. American pilots are watching closely for the outcome of the ongoing investigation in the crash.
It happened in a similar flight regime as the Lion Air and had some behavior characteristics that looked similar to us, but we're not drawing any conclusions. But what our pilots are asking out on the line, and I'm a 737 captain, we're looking across the cockpit and say, okay, let's make sure we're watching this thing.
Captain Dennis Teja flies with the American Airlines. He's also the spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association, the airlines union. And as tensions mount between the East African community neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta met separately with the leaders of the two countries. Experts warn that a conflict between Rwanda and Uganda would have dire consequences on the people on both sides of the border.
Citizens will be on the losing end just because their politicians and rulers do not agree with each other on matters of good governance and principles.
Nambuta Ndebesa is a renowned professor of history and political economy at Uganda's oldest university, Makerere. And in Guinea-Bissau, votes are still being counted after parliamentary elections. Reports say that voting in the country was peaceful and turnout was high as voters cast ballots for a new parliament. Stay tuned, we're covering those stories and more right here on Daybreak Africa. Following this weekend's deadly Ethiopian airline crash, new questions about the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft are leading countries like Indonesia and China to ground their fleet in what experts are calling a sharp break from traditional air safety practice. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein is the first U.S. lawmaker to call on U.S. airlines to follow suit. In a letter to the Federal Aviation Authority, Senator Feinstein said that, quote, until the cause of the crash is known and it's clear that similar risks aren't present in the domestic fleet, I believe all Boeing 737 MAX 8 series aircraft operating in the United States should be temporarily grounded, end quote. Meanwhile, investigations in the Sunday crash are still ongoing. The Director General of the Ethiopian Civil Aviation Authority, Mr. Osenyela Hugna, told VOA that the information recorder, which was recovered from the wreckages of the crashed Ethiopian Airlines plane, were handed over to the International Investigations Team. The Director General also said that search and rescue teams had been deployed to the site of the crash and had been working for two consecutive days round the clock. Meanwhile, pilots around the world are focusing their attention on this crash, as they do to many others. They want to learn what happened to avoid a similar disaster. A preliminary investigation of the Lion Air accident said that the automatic safety system repeatedly pushed the plane's nose downward despite the pilot's attempt to maintain control. Apparently, the plane's software was using incorrect data and was attempting an unnecessary safety maneuver. Pilots said that Boeing had not informed pilots about changes to the safety system. Captain Dennis Teja flies with American Airlines and is a spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association, the airlines union. He tells my colleague Kate Pound Dawson that pilots are now prepared for problems, but still want more information about the latest accident.
After the Lion Air tragedy, there was a real shake in trust. Boeing had not disclosed information about a system that actually triggered during that crash and was part of the reason that the aircraft crashed. Even in our flight manual, they actually said they chose to not disclose that in the pilot flight manual Our company was in the dark as much as we were, American Airlines, and they provided us the information as it came to us from Boeing through and the FAA put out an emergency airworthiness directive. So all that information was placed in our books. We were trained via ground school on that new system, and we were comfortable with knowing that system and how to intervene when it goes awry based on bad information that it was receiving in the Lion Air crash. And now today we have this incident, which it's very, very early, and we're not jumping to conclusions, but it happened in a similar flight regime as the Lion Air and had some behavior characteristics that looked similar to us, but we're not drawing any conclusions. But what our pilots are asking out on the line, and I'm a 737 captain, we're looking across the cockpit and say, okay, let's make sure we're watching this thing. And we're maintaining the margin of safety. We feel like we're prepared, but we also have to we're human beings, so we're dealing with the not too many months ago loss of trust that we had with Boeing that had been repaired. But this incident, it's just natural for us to say, okay, let's keep our wits about us and get all the information here. So it's safe to fly in that aircraft. Our men and women are doing it right now with many of our families on board. We also are very disciplined in making sure that we're the advocate for our passengers. We're a stakeholder in this, but we're also the voice of our passengers when it comes to safety. We're on that airplane with them, and we take that calling and that mission very seriously.
Mr. Dennis Tejo is a pilot with the Allied Pilots Association. He was speaking to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. In the midst of growing tensions between East African community neighbors Rwanda and Uganda, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta met separately with the leaders of the two countries. Kenyatta was in Rwanda yesterday, where he met with President Kagame. He later traveled to Uganda, where he met with Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni. The purpose of Kenyatta's brief visit remains unclear, but there is speculation that he might be playing an intermediary role, trying to broker some form of talks between the two neighbors. Experts say that any conflict between Uganda and Rwanda would certainly be felt in Kenya, which is a route for Rwanda's exports and imports to and from Kenya's port of Mombasa. Mwambutsa Ndebesa is a renowned professor of history and political economy at Uganda's old university, Makerere.
On the economic front, of course, the two countries depend on each other in terms of exchange of goods. Import goods from outside Africa to Rwanda pass through Uganda. So it will affect the import route to Rwanda, and the communities in Rwanda are going to suffer, besides the business people who have been plying between the two countries. And this can even impact on the GDP of the two countries. Uganda could lose a market of Rwanda, and Rwanda loses a market for Uganda, but even the citizens could lose the goods and services that they have been getting from each other's countries. So citizens will be on the losing end just because their politicians and rulers do not agree with each other on matters of good governance and principles.
Professor Ndebesa also says that a conflict between the two countries would have an adverse effect on the citizens on both sides of the border. Many share a common heritage and have traded with each other since pre-colonial times.
The colonial boundaries and borders cut across ethnic groups in Uganda. So you find some Ugandans in, say, Kisoro, who are ethnic Banyarwanda in Uganda, and then they have ethnic Banyarwanda across the border. These are people who are interdependent on each other, and they live a harmonious living, socially and otherwise.
That was Professor Mwambutsa Ndebesa, a renowned scholar of history and political economy at Uganda's oldest university, Makerere. Officials of the Nigerian Independent Electoral Commission, INEC, are currently in the phase of stock-taking following the recent elections. INEC is encouraging candidates who lost the elections to seek legal redress as enshrined in the electoral law. But opposition groups accused INEC of bias and colluding with security and officials of the ruling All Progressive Congress, APC, to rig the elections. The ruling party rejects the accusations as without merit. Meanwhile, local media reports say that INEC has ordered the arrest of two of its officials in Imo State over allegations of voter irregularities and improper conduct. And for more of the latest development, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Nick Danzang, INEC's administrative secretary at the Federal Capital Territory in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The commission is taking stock of the elections just conducted in the states and the Federal Capital Territory. A large number of the governorship and the area council elections in the FCT went very well. The polls opened very early, but there were disruptions in a number of states, as a result of which the results were either inconclusive or suspended. And what the commission is doing now is to take stock of these areas where elections were suspended, including the FCT, and to appoint a date at which it will go back and conduct elections in these areas and get over with the elections.
So, Nick, why were there disruptions in some of these places? Because I understood that INEC was working with security agencies to ensure a peaceful environment for voters to go about choosing their leaders. Why these disruptions, and usually what steps does INEC take in such situations?
Yes, we work with the security agencies to secure the polling units. But in some cases, hoodlums and thugs took over. They overwhelmed the security agents, as a result of which the commission had no recourse than to cancel the elections in those units. And the fact that the elections were cancelled in 30 units made it difficult for the commission to make returns in those areas. So by law, what the commission does is that wherever you have incidents of violence, and this violence affects the outcome of the election such that a return is not made, we return to these areas where violence took place, and we conduct supplementary elections there with a view to making sure that a winner in the contest emerges at the end of the day. So in these areas where violence took place, what the commission intends to do is to go back and conduct elections in these areas, working with the security agents and the stakeholders.
So, Nick, tell me, we understand in Imo State, to be specific, INEC ordered the arrest of its own officials based on some voter irregularities or flouting of INEC rules. What can you tell me about this?
Well, I don't have the details in respect of that. But what I know is that wherever we have challenges and our staff are involved, the sanctions are visited rigorously on them. But I don't have the details on this one. I know that there were disruptions of the election in Imo State, but largely these disruptions were caused by non-INEC staff, not INEC staff.
After taking stock of the election that just happened over the weekend, what's next for INEC to do in this election process?
Well, what the commission will do after taking stock is to sit down and appoint a date when the elections will be completed, and also engage with stakeholders in these areas where elections were not concluded, so that they get prepared for the conduct of the elections. In the FCT, for example, where I am administrative secretary, what we are doing is that we have harvested all the polling units where there were disruptions. We have forwarded them to the commission, and we are awaiting the decision of the commission as to when we'll go back and complete the elections in these polling units. And once the commission appoints a date, we will now summon all stakeholders and discuss with them and see how we can conduct these elections in a peaceful atmosphere, working with key stakeholders such as the political parties, the candidates involved, the security agencies, the media, and members of civil society.
That was Nick Danzang, INEC's administrative secretary in Abuja. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. March is International Women's Month. Around the world, activities to reflect on the progress made towards gender equality started last Friday, the 8th. Mugume Davis Rwakarinji reports that local activists in Uganda are calling for more access to education and mentorship for girls.
Catherine Utamuriza works for Fly UG, a community-based youth organization in Uganda, says women need education so they can be able to participate in decision-making organs. She says educated women know how to defend their rights.
In the old time, we were not so much educated than how we are now. So we couldn't get, like, men could step on us, which we were not given some full rights that we deserve. But apparently we get everything, so we can't do much. We do more. You think now women are shining. They're challenging men. Yeah, that's what we need.
Utamuriza's organization mentors girls in primary and secondary schools across the country. In Uganda, a few women occupy highest positions of influence in socioeconomic as well as political domains. Irene Ashitende Chirabo, the founder of Different Better with a Purpose Foundation, a group of people that advocates for the rights of children, says poverty and literacy hinder efforts aimed at attaining gender equality.
Most of the girls are being married off because they do not have pads. If I'm a girl and I go through my periods every month and I have nothing to use and I have this boyfriend who's going to help me provide me with these pads, why wouldn't I go with him because he's being supportive to me? So our cry is we need to stop that because it has increased on the biggest number of teenage pregnancy and young mothers in the country.
Activists here say gender balance is essential for socioeconomic development. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The votes are still being counted in Guinea-Bissau's parliamentary elections, which happened over the weekend. The country's political powers have been in a back-and-forth battle over leadership that plunged the country into crisis until recently. So the question is, will the parliamentary elections stabilize the country? Well, Vincent Forcher, a researcher for the French National Center for Scientific Research, talks to Ricky Shryock about what these elections could mean for the future of the government.
It's not the elections themselves that are usually difficult. It's what happens after. It's the relationship between the president and the prime minister, because it's a mixed constitution in which both the prime minister, who emanates from the majority at the parliament, and the president have a lot of power, and there's some uncertainty about processes. So the problem usually happens when you have the two institutions finally set up. And so that's what we're going to have to wait for.
Are there any leading politicians who are talking about making changes to the constitution that would address the power split among prime minister and president, et cetera?
I mean, it's been talked about for a long time by foreign, the United Nations and a variety of experts, and it was part of the political agreements signed all these recent years, but it's not been done so far. And I guess political actors see in this imprecision in the constitution a tool that an opportunity, so it's difficult for them to relinquish that.
The other two main parties besides the PSGC are MADEM and PRS, kind of. It looks like they're going to be the other two major parties. Are there any, you know, what are the ideological differences between these parties, or are they more just about personalities per se?
Yeah, I mean, the PSGC has got this this tradition of belonging to the left, to the revolutionary left, and they were the party that led the struggle for independence. But in terms of actual policies, now it doesn't mean a lot. Actually, one of the parties, MADEM, is made of almost exclusively of former PSGC figures who were disgruntled with the current leadership of the PSGC. The other party, the PRS, is officially affiliated to the Liberal International, but again, I mean, that doesn't mean that they have very significantly different policies.
That was Vincent Faucher, a researcher for the French National Center for Scientific Research. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Paris. Nigeria's busy election season is coming to an end with the last leg of elections held across Nigeria this past weekend. The election campaign season is often a boom for certain kinds of businesses or services. Was it a boom this time in Nigeria? As winners and losers emerge from the elections, Okocha in Lagos finds out how the campaigns impacted on small businesses.
In Nigeria, elections come with big spendings. Ahead of voting, political parties spend hundreds of millions of dollars in publicity, logistics, and other campaign materials. But with a fragile recovery from a recession caused by weak oil prices, political parties had less money to spend this year, offering opportunities to small and medium-sized businesses. Still, not all businesses could benefit.
I turned down most of the offer during the election. Most of the printing order during the election, I turned them down because I don't want to live my next 2-3 years paying up debt of 5 million, 10 million or stuff like that.
Ebukun Oloyede, along with his friend, runs Printivo, a Lagos-based print-on-demand service. Ebukun says he had to turn down printing orders from political parties because the payment plans were unfavorable and risky.
Don't let me mention the name of the party, but someone came and said, you know what, we are going to do like A1 posters, 300,000 copies on your delivery day, we'll give you 20%, then 40 days after then, we'll pay you the rest. I'm like, okay, so where do you want me to get money to fund a job worth 40 million naira for you? Like, seriously? So I turned down most of those offers.
Still, printing services make up a number of businesses that typically benefit from electioneering seasons, and this year is not an exception in Nigeria. Print shop operator Ibukun has no regrets from the offers they turned down.
It's a very smart, good move for me, because most of those who came with those proposals, their candidate lost. I will have been in a serious debt by now.
Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Thousands of delegates across the world are gathering in Nairobi for the second day to engage in the highest level decision-making body on matters of environment. Maureen Ojambo has this report from Nairobi.
19 delegates, among them United Nations workers, never made it to the event as they perished in the Sunday plane crash that was en route to Nairobi from Addis Ababa. And during the summit on Monday morning, a moment of silence was observed in respect to those who perished. Maimuna Sharif, acting Director General of United Nations Office in Nairobi, led the team of delegates in mourning the departed souls.
I stand before you on the first day of the United Nations Environment Assembly, which has officially commenced today. In the wake of this tragedy, as we mourn, let us reflect that our colleagues were willing to travel and work far from their homes and loved ones to help make the world a better place to live. The United Nations office at Nairobi is ready to support all those touched by this tragedy. With the support of our headquarters, counselors have been made available in Nairobi, Addis Ababa and Geneva. Call centers will also be established. In closing, I wish to express my deepest condolences and prayers to the great nation of Ethiopia and to the families of the passengers and the crew members who lost their life in this tragedy.
More than 4,000 delegates are attending the assembly that is set to come to an end on Friday, 15th March. Kenya's Environment Minister Keriako Tobiko said that the country is committed towards ensuring safe environment for its people.
We are pursuing reuse and recycling of appropriate solid waste while installing sanitary landfill. As the world knows, Kenya in 2017 legally prohibited the manufacture, import, sale and use of plastic carrier bags, single-use carrier bags, owing to their contribution to pollution.
France President Emmanuel Macron is expected at the summit tomorrow, Wednesday, to give his keynote. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Tuesday, March the 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.